Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Good Areas Live. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me is my good mate and one half of the Caribbean Cricket Podcast, Mashal St. Patrick Hewitt. How are you doing, Mash?
Yeah, I'm all right, you know. What day is it, say? I don't even know what day it is, but we're a few days out from West Indies' latest defeat in Test cricket, but I'm doing okay.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a lot about that. That's what this podcast is about. But just to let all of our viewers know, this podcast is powered by our supporters on Patreon. You could become one of them, by the way, by going to patreon.com/goodareaspodcast. And then you can get ad-free content, talk to us exclusively, give us quick picks ideas, all of that fun stuff. But anyway, now, Mash, Australia have smashed the West Indies in the second test match in Grenada by 133 runs. And they're, of course, 2-0 up now. They've taken an unassailable lead in the series, the three-match series, and they have retained the Frank Worrell Trophy, which they've retained since 1995, if I'm not wrong. But if you look at these two test matches, especially the first one, like, for the first 2 days, the West Indies had a proper shot at winning it. In fact, they should have won that test match had they held on to their catches. And of course, had the TV umpiring been a bit better. And over here as well, theoretically, right, the West Indies were in this game for a long time as well. So when you look at this new era under coach Darren Sammy and captain Roston Chase, how satisfied are you?
Right now, it's a 6 out of 10. Okay. And I'm mindful that some people will hear that, particularly the West Indian based supporters will hear that and say, how can you say that? They've lost by 150 odd and then 130 odd. But I always like to kind of put the context this way, right? This isn't number 8 West Indies versus number 9 Pakistan, respectfully. Hmm. And I deliberately say Pakistan because I'm talking to you. This is number 8 West Indies versus number 1 Australia. So I think a lot of people have done like a false comparison between, oh yeah, but we just went to Pakistan and drew 1-1. And now we've changed the team. So why did we change the team? That same team that played Pakistan should have played against Australia, as if Pakistan are good. So like that doesn't make sense to me, right? So it's a 6 out of 10 because in any normal scenario, if you put the number one team, obviously some people will try to claim it's South Africa. It isn't. It's Australia. If you put the number one team in a sport versus a team that should be relegated in a sport or in the same league, you would expect that number one team to win 99 times out of 100. So what's happened in this test series so far is that normal service has resumed. Just like every other time we've played Australia, bar that one miracle at the Gabba for the first time in 29 years or whatever it was, right? So just normal service has resumed. But actually, maybe it's even a bit too glib to say normal service because actually there are positives in the course of this test series. West Indies have taken 20 wickets in both test matches. Hmm. Now, again, I'm not sure how many of the weaker test nations, so that's basically us, Pakistan, Ireland, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. I'm not sure how many of those weaker test nations would have been able to take all 20 wickets against Australia in both test matches so far. So I think one thing we can clearly say is that West Indies have a top-tier bowling attack, right? That has caused Australia problems. But people seem to have conveniently forgotten that Australia also have a top-tier bowling attack.
Probably the most well-oiled pace attack in the last decade easily, right? And I mean, I don't mean to be a dampener of moods over here, but there is something that I really need to discuss with you, and it can't wait, right? Mm. Shamar Joseph has been in crazy form, as he always is versus Australia, picked up 9 wickets in the first test, and even over here, he picked up 5 wickets, including 4 for 66 the second time he bowled. But it is a bit of a, or it's all left a sour taste in our mouths after all of those allegations came about from, you know, reliable news sources, right? Based on what I read on Caribbean Cricket Podcast, they were fairly authentic. And it's 11 women who have spoken up. And then some of those details are so grotesque that I don't even want to get into them, right? How do you feel about this? How do you unpack those emotions? And do you think he should be playing this series anymore? Because I don't know. I've never been quite happy with how sport deals with these kinds of things.
Okay, you've really thrown me that hospital pass. Listen, I'm going to refer to that specific West Indian player as number 70 for now. A week ago, somebody asked me a very similar question to yourself. And what I said to that person was, I think Cricket West Indies are caught between a rock and a hard place here. Because my argument then was that if Cricket West Indies do something, and by do something, I mean, I don't know, tell number 70 to sit or bring out a statement and so on and so forth, they could open themselves up to all kinds of, and I'm no lawyer, but they could open themselves up to all kinds of mitigations about, well, actually, no one's been formally charged of anything. So how can you do X? How can you do Y when there is no formal charge? Yes, there's plenty of stuff out there in the in the media space, but no formal documentation or charge currently has been presented in the public sphere, right? For people to digest. In that regard, therefore, Cricket West Indies are probably well within their rights to say, well, we can't act on what we don't formally know. Okay. This isn't me trying to run interference for them. This is just me trying to look at it as balanced as I can. So there's that. There's a second side of it, though, which is that, okay, all of that is true, but the story is already out in the public sphere. And the story could be completely untrue, but also on the flip side, could be very much true.
Yeah.
Let's work with let's just say hypothetically, the stories are very much true. They're heinous, right? Yeah. So then there's the part of me which says, where does an organization stand on organizational reputation being at risk here? And where is the line between, there is no formal charge to any of these rumors and accusations, so actually we can't address it formally, versus rumors and accusations are out there in the public, media houses are talking about it and so on and so forth, so maybe the best thing for the reputation of the organization is to rest said player whilst whatever needs to be done or whatever needs to be cleared up is cleared up. Yep. It seems that they have decided to take the former approach, which is to say, well, actually, there's nothing formal out there, so we can't be seen to be doing something when there's nothing formal to be doing something against. So, and you can tell I'm trying to tread carefully with everything that I'm saying here.
Yeah.
I guess fundamentally what I would say is this, the onus in everything to do with this, as things stand right now, the onus for me is actually with authorities and legal people in Guyana. That's where the story has broken from. So the next step is up to the people in Guyana to take the next step, whether that be legal, whether that be legal actions from alleged victims, whether that be legal actions from a possible defense, whether that be authorities in Guyana doing their job. They have to start the process. And again, I'm not trying to run interference for Cricket West Indies. Irrespective of whether we should criticize Cricket West Indies or not, the process has to start in Guyana first. And my bigger concern right now isn't actually what Cricket West Indies have or haven't done. My biggest concern is what has or hasn't been going on in Guyana. That's actually my big... And Darren Sammy alluded to this with the word justice. Justice must be served, right? Whether that be justice for a victim, whether that be whoever the victim is in this scenario, because remember, people are innocent until proven guilty. So justice must be served. And the justice, whatever the justice is, and whoever deserves the justice, it needs to start in Guyana first. So for now, Cricket West Indies can argue that, well, you know, technically we can't do X, Y, Z. And I personally am not happy with it. But technically, they can argue such and such, and that's why we're doing X, Y, Z. But, and I know I've waffled on for a while, fundamentally, none of it sits well with me.
Yeah.
None of it sits well with me. And it has made for very uncomfortable viewing in this second test, to the point where I was not celebrating certain things. I guess that's how I'd phrase it.
I saw the first test match in its entirety, every single delivery, and I cannot tell you all the things that I felt on day three, right? Because you're just like, man, I mean, we were all rooting for the West Indies and all of a sudden I need to watch this guy smash sixes and take wickets now. So I understand that sentiment, and I also understand the whole rationale that the legal process needs to start in Guyana first and that's where the investigation should begin. But, you know, just to kind of close up on this, there's one last thing I want to ask you. We've seen this in cricket before with Sandeep Lamichane, Scott Kugelein, Makaya Ntini. We've seen these people be protected. And they've continued to play as well. And these cases are often taken back, right? The charges are kind of taken back and everything. For you, I'm not saying what should happen. I'm just asking you personally, right? Would you axe him from the team once the case is filed or once the trials begin? Because clearly that is the path forward. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this.
If it was me, I would have acted already.
Yeah, that's true.
I would have acted already, and I would have. Like I say, I'm not sure of the legalities of everything around it, but I can only speak for me, right? If it was me, and I was a stakeholder, and I had the power to do anything around selections and things like that, I would already have acted and said, you know what? Irrespective of what is or isn't true, and what is or isn't going on. Go and attend to your affairs. That's what I would have done. That's not assuming guilt. That's not assuming innocence. I would have just said, you need to go and attend to your affairs. Because right about now, from a reputation, like as I said earlier on, from a reputation perspective, it's out in the open. So to protect yourself, to protect the organization, to protect the brand, you need to go and take care of your affairs. That's what I would have done.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be waiting. I wouldn't be waiting for it, and now there's this formality. Because if anything, let's say argument's sake, something happens in the next few weeks to the next few months, right? And some level of formality is announced. It's going to look very bad.
Yes. Do
you see where I'm coming from?
I know you're a football guy, Mash. You're a football guy. 2.5 years is what it took to get those charges kind of laid down versus Thomas Partey, right? From Arsenal. So these things tend to take time.
So using that then as an example, there is an argument to say that somebody is allowed to continue their career because nothing's actually... Do you see what I mean? So that's why I'm trying to look at it from both angles. Because at the end of the day, again, to kind of look at it from the flip side, these are just stories. These are stories that have got out amongst the media. We don't know them to be true. Does that mean that there should be a halt put to someone's career? Arguably, no. But on a moral and emotional level, yes. But moral and emotional level isn't legality. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, 100%.
So there's different ways to approach it. But me personally, I would have asked the individual, you know what, go and attend to your affairs for now, because it's better for you as well as better for the organization.
Yeah, West Indies cricket as a brand as well suffers over here. And plus, you want kids to watch the sport, and that isn't a great message to send out. So I think I would have done pretty much the same as what you kind of expressed over here. Anyway, I promise you, this is the end of all the difficult talk in this podcast. We're going to come and talk about some performances now. But before
it's
that,
too late. Shall... It's too late. You finished me already.
But before that, we will be taking a short break. You guys are watching Good Areas Live with Behram and Mashal, and go nowhere because we will be back in like half a minute.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
Welcome back to Good Areas Live. You guys are with Behram and Mashal, and we are about to talk about performances, but I think it's also important to kind of mention, and I think I know I speak for the both of us, that if there was anything where you felt that we misspoke We apologize in advance because it's a sensitive topic. And also, we're always thinking about the victims over here. That's what we do at Good Areas. All right. Coming to West Indies bowling, of course, you mentioned how they've taken 20 wickets in both test matches. We saw Jaden Seals do really well in the first one. And his average and strike rate combination right now is otherworldly. He picked up six, I think, in that test match. And Alzari Joseph picks up six wickets in this test match, including 4 for 61 in the first innings. Alzari is a very interesting case study for me. Because you know he's talented. He was fast-tracked after doing really well in under-19 cricket or at that level. And we know he's quick. But he's been a little erratic. He hasn't really been able to bring his best foot forward on a consistent basis. And every now and then you will see him, you know, do really well on the cricket field. But it's been, you know, kind of sandwiched between a lot of filth. So how do you look at his career?
First things first, Alzari Joseph is a good white ball bowler. So I always think it's important to ascertain that first, because sometimes when we look at his test performances, it can obfuscate the fact that he's not like a top class, but he's a very good white ball bowler in both T20 and ODI cricket. In fact, I'd go as far as to say he's West Indies' best white ball bowler. Doesn't mean he's always good, but he belongs in the top tier. He's in the top third of white ball bowlers in terms of skill sets in international cricket. That's what makes his middling numbers in test cricket so baffling, because it's not like he started off in white ball. He started off in test cricket. He was fast tracked into test cricket. I just think, I mean, it's a very simplistic way of looking at it, and I could be completely wrong. But I think there's three different things you can look at with Alzari Joseph. One, he probably was exposed too soon, Jaden Seals has been exposed very soon. So actually, maybe it's nothing about being exposed too soon. But he was probably exposed too soon with way too much hype on his shoulders. Uh-huh. Jaden Seals at least was able to tour with the West Indies and get used to the camps first, before he just got frustrated into international cricket. Alzari literally went from under-19 straight into the test team, right? So he got exposed too soon. I think he was asked to take on a senior role too soon, or a lot was expected of him at too young an age. So again, Jaden Seals has done brilliantly, right?
Yes.
But Jaden Seals wasn't put on a pedestal. Alzari Joseph, when he came into the team at from under-19s, was put on a pedestal because of what he'd done. Like, Jaden Seals was all right at under-19 level, but he didn't come in with like, and this is going to be the guy. Whereas Alzari Joseph came into international cricket with, this is a throwback to the former years of West Indies fast bowling greats. He can crank it up to 90. He's going to be legit. And again, it's that classic thing that we have in West Indies cricket where reality doesn't meet expectation. People are still probably holding Alzari Joseph to an expectation in test cricket that's just not what he does. Now, he's coming up to, or he is now, 27, 28, I believe he is. Kumar Roach has obviously been retired. Shannon Gabriel has gone. And it may just be, I may be speaking too soon, but it may just be that we start to see the best of Alzari Joseph in test cricket, because he now has to be the guy. If you see what I mean,
he
is expected now to bowl like he is the pack leader. That doesn't mean bowlers, you are our best bowler, but it does mean marshal the pack. Make sure that we're bowling as a unit. You are the senior guy. Roach is gone now. You are the senior guy of this pace attack. You have fundamentally more experience than Jaden Seals, Anderson Phillip, Shamar Joseph, etc. And we've seen glimpses at the back end of 2024. He bowled down Bangladesh, didn't go to Pakistan. And now in this series, he's been bowling well. But the whole unit has been bowling well. It's noticeable that his performances in this test series so far have coincided with Ravi Rampal becoming West Indies bowling coach. I don't want to speak too soon, but I want to see how that continues to develop. But we have to remember he's just 28 years old. Like, he's possibly not even reached his prime yet.
His best years could be ahead of him.
Yeah, exactly. And if that's the case, if he's, let's just say he's not his prime, if he's got to the age of 28 and he's played, I can't remember how many test matches he's had now, but he's basically taken 100 odd wickets. I think he's taken them at like 33s. If he's now going to kick on from there, that's not a bad place to be kicking on from. It's not like we're talking like a guy who's taken 100 wickets at 38, if you see what I mean.
You basically want an Ishant Sharma-esque arc for Alzari, or that's what you're hoping for, right?
Yeah, exactly. Somebody who finds the true form in the back end of his career and takes... So it is not out of the realms of possibility that Alzari Joseph ends his test career with an average under 30.
It's not beyond the realms of possibility, definitely not, especially with the sort of surfaces that they started to curate in the West Indies, right, across the Caribbean, maybe barring Guyana, I would say. But here's a really interesting stat by Varun underneath, where he mentions how Alzari's standard deviation for economy is 1.52, which makes him one of the most high variance seamers in tests, 13th out of 125. So that's something that he needs to basically rectify, and he needs to kind of continue to deliver consistent performances. And now he's got the experience, like you said, that he's only 28 and his peak could well be ahead of him. And then he will have Jaden Seals for sure at the other end, because we don't really know what will happen to player number 70. But Seals has 85 wickets in 20 test matches with an average of 22 and a strike rate of 39. He's not express, but he knows how to bowl in that channel, and he's generally a really good athlete. So that's exciting. I don't think they should have force retired Kemar Roach so early, though, because I don't know. Anderson Phillip is a bit new right now. There is promise over there, but I thought Kemar could still play on for a bit.
Yeah. The story, as I understand it, from speaking to people who would know, is ultimately they've decided that this is a 2-year test cycle, right? Up to 2027. By the end of this test cycle, Kemar Roach would be just about to turn 39. So they fundamentally made a decision that, come on, can we realistically be playing, can we realistically be expecting to play a 38, 39-year-old in a 2-year test cycle, right? And I get it. From that perspective, I completely get it, which is why I had long said before we went into this series, are they going to give him a farewell in Barbados? Because that's what I was expecting. I was like, right, he's about to turn 37. He's probably very close to wrapping this all up. I think I said it last year when we went to Pakistan. And last year I said the perfect time to say to Kemar Roach, come on, it's over now, would be Barbados versus Australia. Give him his last test in his home country. And I think he would gladly step away with that. That's what's disappointing. It's not so much the longer term view of, come on, we have to like blood the younger guys now. It's more so that it's another legend of the game who has gone out in West Indies cricket without being honoured the right way. That's more my issue.
He is an unsung hero in world cricket, I would say, as far as the test arena is concerned. And after Courtney and Kirtley, no one else has taken that many wickets as a seamer. I think it's close to what? How many is it now, actually? Has he crossed 300?
No, I think so. He's going to retire on, what, 287, I think it is?
Mean, I agree with you. I feel like in this sort of scenario, you could potentially give someone a farewell test, but I suppose Darren Sammy has Jimmy Anderson'd him in a way, which is sad to see. But overall, are you happy with the fact that the West Indies, as a venue, is now offering spicy decks which assist fast bowlers? Is that the best way forward? And does it make it tricky in the sense that West Indies' Achilles heel, barring their fielding, of course, is their batting, right? I mean, Brandon King, with 75 in his first dig in this test match, is the only 50-plus score for any West Indian in this series. That is an issue. So does this work as a strategy then?
I'm still up in the air about what the right thing to do is. Because I get it, right? Bowling is our strength. So prepare wickets that feed our strength. But when there is such disparity between one suit and the other, it's not like bowling is our strength. And it's not like we're saying bowling is brilliant and batting is okay. We're saying bowling is brilliant and batting is terrible. Right?
Yeah.
So when you have such a huge disparity, how can you prepare a pitch just for one of them? Because you're asking your batting to have to turn in world like similar to the miracle at the at Gabba. You're asking the batting to turn in performances that they have otherwise shown that they are not capable of being able to do. And when a team is incapable of doing that, you'll never be able to do it consistently. So you have to ask yourself, so how do we make our weakness become stronger? The answer to that can't be to just focus on our strength. It can't be, because the batting will never improve them. But then again, the flip side, I love to always say what the flip side is. The flip side is this: we're playing Australia. It doesn't matter if you focus on your strength. It doesn't matter if you focus on your weakness. Australia are going to outgun us either way. So if you prepare a pitch to bat on, then Steve Smith will score 670 runs by himself, right?
Yep.
So that doesn't help either. If you prepare a pitch to bowl on, cool, we'll take 20 Australian wickets, but Australia will bowl us out for less than 150 because they've got a literal all-time bowling attack. So if it helps us, God knows what it's going to do to Australia against our brittle batting ability. Look at Pakistan. Pakistan tried that against us. They tried to throw those spin wickets on us, forgetting that they're useless as well. So when they threw the spin wickets on us, they forgot, wait a minute, we can't bat either. And then subsequently, it became a, well, who's going to bat worse showdown?
That's true.
So it does, this idea of solely playing to your strength doesn't actually lead to, so I don't know when Pakistan next play again this year, but to carry on the Pakistan analogy, I'm going to be very intrigued to see what Pakistan do the next time they play at home, because this notion of you only create pitches that play to your obvious strength doesn't, I'm not convinced that actually helps improve your team.
I think Pakistan's obvious strength isn't even spin bowling, right? They had just prepared flat deck on flat deck. And when they tried to prepare seamer-friendly conditions, it was also flat deck. That this was their last roll at the dice, right? They took that gamble. But then again, I know this is a tangent, but I feel like they should just ask their curator, Tony Hemming, to curate like UAE-esque surfaces, which they know they can do well on, right? There's a bit in it for batting, or a lot in it for batting in the first 3 days or so, and then they start to turn the surfaces. But anyway, that's a conversation for a separate day. One last thing I want to talk with respect to the West Indies is, how dire is the catching? I know they didn't drop as many in this test match, but they did drop catches, right? That is bad. And then also, you know, you need to invest in batters in this format. They will get good over a period of time. Pakistan, West Indies, Sri Lanka, New Zealand, we don't get to play a lot of test cricket. I've personally felt like someone like an Alec Athanase would have gotten better with time. I actually quite like Joshua De Silva, and now it seems like he's out of the plans. Explain this to me as to why have there been so many wholesale changes to the squad?
Only Darren Sammy can fundamentally answer that question, but reading between the lines, they are adamant that they have looked at and crunched all of the numbers, all of the data. And I think sometimes in West Indies cricket, particularly West Indian fans, get confused by the use of the word numbers and data, because the general understanding of numbers and data amongst the West Indian fan base, and possibly even our media as well, is, well, this guy averages this and that's it. That's the extent to which data analysis goes in West Indian cricket. I am assuming that when Sammy and Avinesh, the analysts, talk about data and numbers, they're talking on a deeper level about ability to make runs versus this type of bowling, ability to play on this type of wicket, ability to make runs in this type of situation. That's what I'm assuming it means, right? Mm. So they've crunched all the numbers, and basically after crunching everything, they've looked at their team and said, right, the current incumbents, so what's that? Who's gone? Mikhail Louie, Kevin Hodge, Alec Athanase, Josh De Silva. They're the most high profile four that have
Kevin
gone.
Sinclair is also out, isn't he?
Yeah. They've looked at those players ultimately and come to the conclusion that you do not breed any confidence that you will be able to make runs on any consistent level, right? Or certainly not now, not in your current iteration of who you are as a batter. And I think there's truth in that. I see the stat that's on the screen. I'll add another stat before you read that stat out. I pulled the numbers, right? West Indies, before the start of this series, West Indies had scored under 250 29 times out of their last 37 innings, right? That's not with these new players. That's with the ones that everyone's trying to convince me should have stayed in the team. Right? Mm. That's with the ones who have just been dropped. They rarely passed 250 runs. You can't win test matches if you can't even score past 250, right? much. Yeah. That's before I even tell you about how few times they passed 200 runs, right? Mm. Which is ridiculous as a stat in itself, right? And then on the screen, I can see since 2021, West Indies have lost batting average. So
22, when, by the way, which is really low.
So when Sammy then turns around and goes, I'm bringing in these guys that all previous selectors have refused to pick because they've pigeonholed them as white ball players.
And also, there's a common theme over there, Mash. A few of those guys like Shea Hope and Casey Carty have been doing really well in ODI cricket, which is kind of the middle ground between T20s and Test cricket. So I think that was the rationale. These guys have been scoring runs for the West Indies. So let's usher them into the Test squad, right?
Exactly, right? So it's almost like it's a Hail Mary pass without being a Hail Mary pass, in so much as just saying these guys score international runs. International runs has to have some kind of currency. Certainly, for me, and I will always maintain this, international runs has more currency than domestic runs in West Indies cricket. And the reason why I know it has more currency than domestic runs is because our domestic cricket system has not produced one good test batter in 25 years. So I know the domestic runs don't mean anything. So when
you've got Darren Bravo.
Well, now, but then obviously that's another player we forced out. So that's another story for another day, right? But so if you know that your domestic system doesn't produce anyone, right, you can't just keep saying, well, let's pick the latest flavor who scored runs in the domestic. 2 years ago, Alec Athanase top scored in our domestic system. He's come into Test cricket. He averages 25. Mikhail Louie top scored in our domestic system. He came into Test cricket. He averages 19. Domestic runs doesn't correlate to anything. Now, does that mean ODI runs correlate to anything? No, not necessarily either. But if you ask me to pick, I'd rather pick the guy who has 17 ODI centuries before I pick the guy who's top scored in our domestic system. So
Varun has a question for you over here. He says, is Mash suggesting the method of vibes? I think he's just suggesting the method that you trust guys who have scored runs at international level and have spent time on the crease, if I've got this right.
Shea Hope's 17 ODI centuries have to mean something. They just simply have to mean something. Yes, people always say to me, but Shea Hope averaged 25 in Test cricket the last time he played any significant amount of Test cricket. And that's all true and that's all valid. But the last time he played Test cricket was 2021 until now. So do you mean to tell me that we can't... do you mean to tell me that in 4 years since then, we haven't seen any reason to try Shea Hope again? Like, I don't... What does the ODI average of 50 mean then? Beggars can't be choosers. We don't have Craig Brathwaite's average. If he doesn't get dropped in Jamaica, his average is about to plummet under 30, which will mean that the West Indies team officially has no batters over who've got a test match average over 30. When you're in that position, I think you better try something different. I think you better try something. You better look at something else and try something different, because obviously what's been happening in the past doesn't work.
Yeah, here's another stat by Varun, who says since 2021, the number 8 averages more than the number 3 for the West Indies. Varun, the number 8 for many teams would average more than the number 3 these days, right? No, I mean, apart from Wiaan Mulder and maybe we're entering into the age of the false threes. But anyway, I think that's enough on the West Indies. I do want to talk a bit about Australia as well with you before you take your leave. But before that, we shall be taking a short break. You guys are watching Good Areas Live with Behram and Mashal, and we'll be back in like half a minute. So stay on.
I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things: the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny SIMs and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally.
Welcome back to Good Areas Live. You guys are with Behram and Mashal. And look, let's go back to the first day, right? And the West Indies are bowling, and they once again have Australia on the ropes, 5 down for 110. And then those two guys walk out who must have been really frustrating to watch throughout these two test matches for you. Bo Webster and Alex Carey. Webster scores 60. I think Carey scores 63. They did pretty much the same thing in the previous test match. Carey is more counter-attacking and Webster has this weird thing where he knows his limitations, somehow survives being that tall, and then cashes in on width. So how frustrating has it been watching those two guys do well?
I like Alex Carey. I wouldn't say either Bo Webster or Alex Carey are players that I'd pay to watch in any traditional sense. But I do like so if I do with Carey first, I like the fact that Alex Carey backs his ability. Let me think of wicket keepers around the world. So obviously you've got Rishabh Pant and Jamie Smith looks like he's showing bits and pieces. But there's an argument to say that Alex Carey's in the top three wicket keepers in the world, right?
It's between him and Rizwan, probably.
Probably between him and Rizwan, yeah. Right? But what I like about Carey is Carey fits the model of, irrespective of what Australia are doing, he's going to try and play a punchy counter-attacking role. Yeah. That's what he's done in the two test matches so far. And it won't always work, but he's a gutsy cricketer. He'll fight fire with fire. Not in the spectacular sense like Pant, but in the more classical sense of, right, you're not going to dictate to me how this is going to go. If I'm out, I'm out, but I'm going to try and dictate how this is going to go, right?
Yeah.
So he's kind of got his niche in the Australia side.
And he continues to score clutch runs, right? He may not score a lot of runs. But he's super clutch.
Yeah,
but Webster is an interesting case study because this guy might not even retain his spot once Cam Green can bowl again, right? And he has made himself kind of undroppable. He scores 50 after 50 in literally every test match he plays, and he's a unit. In fact, Cam Green and Bo Webster at like fourth slip and gully is almost unfair, right? That's a wingspan of an airplane.
Yeah, I think Webster, I keep calling him, when we do shows on the Caribbean Cricket Podcast, I keep calling Webster a journeyman, which sounds super disrespectful. And it probably is disrespectful. But at the same time, I hope people understand why I'm calling him that. Like, a guy turns up at the age of 31 in the Australian test side, and with the greatest of respects to Bo Webster, very few people know who he is. They don't. Bo Webster's in the Australia side, and people still don't know who he is, right? So, like, he's the archetype of what I'd expect a journeyman cricketer who's made the most of his ability, right? What's he got? Oh, he's already got four test 50s. I think this is only his seventh test match or sixth test match, whatever.
Picks up crucial wickets with his right arm medium.
He's like a golden arm medium pacer, right?
And he can bowl off spin if need be. So he's versatile. Right. I like to think of him as a Sheffield Shield hustler because he had played 100 first class games prior to debuting for Australia, right? And he is just a thorough professional. He knows his game really well and he's cashing in big time.
He knows his game. And that's why there is a lot to be said for guys who get to international cricket. They don't look exciting. There's nothing noticeable really about them, but they've done the hard yards. And because they've done the hard yards, they know Bo Webster accentuates his positives and hides his negatives. He knows what works for him and he stays within the parameters and limitations of what works for him. Now, at some point in his career, one of two things is going to happen. He's either, as you said, going to lose his spot in the side because Cam Green will bowl and therefore Cam Green replaces Bo Webster. Or two, eventually, teams will slowly start to figure him out. But as is the way with Australia, by the time he gets figured out, he'll have had a really good career because he got his baggy green and he absolutely maximized his opportunities when he got his baggy green. And that's all you can do. He's a lesson to any journeyman cricketer for any international side in the world. When you get your chance, stick to the fundamentals of what got you there, cash in, and make it hard for them to drop you. That's the guide right there. He's just given the blueprint to everyone.
quite literally an inspiration for all of those, you know, journeymen or hustlers. And then, of course, I always say this, that even if, you know, ultimately cricket doesn't work out, he can always become a bouncer outside of some club. I'm not entering that club, right, when Bo Webster is the bouncer, I suppose. But anyway, some other Australian players scored runs. And Steve Smith was back in the side after his dislocated finger. Him scoring 71 comes as no surprise. But I'm more interested in Cam Green, or as I like to call him these days, Cam Threen, right? Because he also is a false number three. And I mean, he needs to pick up his slack because Wiyan Mulder just scored unbeaten, or you know, an unbeaten 367 and then declared. But he also scored 52 in this game. I didn't watch it. Was he convincing? Was he lucky? What was it like?
I wouldn't use either of those words. I'd say he was better in... Okay. In that, I think he simplified his game more. Maybe it helped that he was batting with Steve Smith at the other end. I just felt he was more compact. Like, if you think about how he'd got, if you think about how he'd got out so far in the series, it was always chasing the wide one and nicking off to second or third slip, and needlessly so as well. Yeah, there was often a bit of a hint of swing, but there was a few dismissals where it was like, why are you chasing the ball on a sixth stump line? You don't have to do that. Maybe he'd convinced himself that he has to be a dominating attacking number three. What I saw in that innings of 52 was, I'm now going to just play this situation. I think Australia were what overnight? In fact, when he came in, they were. I think Nathan Lyon got out, so they were 28 for... No, tell a lie. He was already in. So when Nathan Lyon got out, they were 28 for three. And then Steve Smith came out, right? And I think they just made a decision that, right, our aim is to take this game as long and as deep as possible. We're not going to chase runs. We're just going to wait for the bad balls, put them away, stay compact, play straight. That's all he did. And he nudged and nurdled his way to 52. That's how probably a test match number three is supposed to play.
These days, at least.
Yeah, so I think maybe...
Maybe on more batting-friendly surfaces, you could go and, you know, cause some chaos. But when you are playing on these sort of surfaces that have been on offer in the Caribbean, you've got to kind of... I don't know actually what you do. Maybe you're more successful trying to attack, or maybe you should just like shut up shop and try to be pragmatic. I do not know what the correct path would be.
I think if you haven't got a good technique, you have to attack, right? If you haven't got if you haven't got a good enough defensive technique to stay out there for a long time, like a Steve Smith, you have to counterattack. I think Cam Green has been, that's why I say I think Cam Green's been caught between a rock and a hard place, in that his natural game, I think, is to probably attack, but he's only now just realized you haven't been served up the wickets to be able to play. No one, not even Travis Head, has tried to play his natural game. And even he has had to, at times, be like, you know, I have to just dig in here. I can't just try blasting the ball to the boundary. It's not the type of wicket to be doing that. Do you see what I mean? So people have had to rein in their egos and play the pitch on its merits.
Yeah, and even though he was the player of the match in the previous test, he got dropped. He should have been out when he wasn't, right, with the caught behind thing. So he's kind of ridden his luck as well. And here's to hoping for the West Indies that they can hold on to some of their catches in the next test. I didn't watch much of this test match, Mashal. So just a few things that I want to really talk to you about is, first, I'm looking at the scorecard right now. Nathan Lyon takes 3 for 75 in his first bowling innings and then 3 for 42 on a surface that shouldn't have aided him. What went on over there?
I'm trying to remember who he got rid of. Certainly in the second innings, he played the kind of rope-a-dope in so much as, if you want to try and hit big sixes off me, by all means, go and do that. But I'm Nathan Lyon. I will get you out. Right? Yeah, you're going to hole out in the deep at some point. So that was the second. I'm trying to remember what happened in the first. It wasn't a pitch that was ragging and turning or anything like that. I think, again, it's just, I mean, it's two things. One, he's Nathan Lyon, right? You have to give it to the Australians. They will play Nathan Lyon regardless.
Yeah,
right? Look at what West Indies did. We got to Grenada and we're like, we'll drop our frontline spinner for a pacer. Yeah. Australia didn't even remotely think about that as an option. They're like, no, we're playing Nathan Lyon regardless, right? He's a wicket-taking bowler regardless. So I just think part of it is, regardless of if it was slogging that got people out, Nathan Lyon's just a wicket-taker. And it's rare that Nathan Lyon is not involved in some shape or form in an Australian victory. So more kudos to Australia for not for not succumbing to the West Indian temptation of saying, no, we'll just need pace for this wicket. Like, no, yeah, a balanced attack. And there were times in this test match where West Indies were dying for a few Warrican overs just to try drag back a bit of control at some points. Do you see what I mean? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Gaza hadn't performed too well in recent times, so he really needed this performance. Okay, I have two more things to talk to you about. We have 5 minutes. So tell me, in 20 seconds, who is opening the batting for Australia in the Ashes? I doubt it's going to be Constance and Khwaja. Maybe Khwaja because of the experience, but looks a bit tough for Sam Constance.
Khwaja and Labuschagne.
That's an interesting one. Because they could go to Bancroft.
Just right now.
Yeah. They could go to Bancroft or Marcus Harris or Matt Renshaw eventually, but there are no easy answers over here. That's the biggest issue that's going on with them.
It's and definitely lastly, not Constance. That much I do know. It's not him.
Lastly, the final test match in Jamaica, is it? It is going to be a day-night test. And Mitch Stark, who is a pink pill pulverizer, is pretty much the best at it. He will also be playing his 100th test match. He's been very, very, very terrific or incredible even with the new ball throughout the series. The numbers may not reflect it. 1 for 48 in his first bowling innings and then what? 3 for 24. Okay, he's good over there. This is basically going to be a Stark show from what I get. And if they choose to play Scotty Boland over here, then this might be quite a one-sided test, I fear.
Yeah, I think a good result for the West Indies in this test match is if it lasts 3 days. I think I said it on the final day after we lost in Grenada. I said that if West Indies have to bat at any point in this pink ball test match, when the ball is moving, we are getting bowled out for less than 100 runs.
If it happened,
I wouldn't have had a pink ball test match in the Caribbean. Obviously, they've done it for they must have done it for the Australian audience. But West Indies have to hope that they win the toss. And that the only reason I say that is because then it allows them to dictate the time that they actually get to bat, if you see what I mean. I'm not, but do you know what? For people who are listening to this show, who possibly don't know much about this series or don't know much about the West Indies, here's my actual prediction for the test match, Biram. The lights are going to fail at some point in this test match.
All right, then. Well, I personally feel that.
I want production in the background to clip that and remind me of it.
I personally feel that even though you've just mentioned that Australia, it's admirable how they stick with Nathan Lyon, this might be the test match to drop him. I would like to see them go with the four-man pace attack with Scotty Boland and the pink ball because he's quite good with it as well. But anyway, let's see.
I would. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, let's see what happens over there. That kind of brings us towards an end to this show. Thank you to everyone in the comment section for your interactions. Don't forget to go and follow, subscribe, and go listen to the guys at Caribbean Cricket Podcast. They are the leaders when it comes to covering all things West Indian cricket. And I mean, they're my favorite, so here's my endorsement. And of course, just a quick reminder to all of you, you guys can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. That can prove to be a one-stop shop for all the fun work that we do as part of our team, whether it be written pieces, podcasts, or videos. And of course, once again, these podcasts are powered by our supporters on Patreon. So you can become one by going to patreon.com/goodareaspodcast. And also that will then allow you to enjoy ad-free content, interact with us exclusively, talk about all the random shit you want to talk about and take the piss out of each other. And it's a very, very happy community, better than cricket, Reddit or whatever. And I'm sure the boys at CCP also have a Patreon. So go ahead, promote it. How do they join that?
You asked me to promote it like I know where it is. Patreon. patreon.com/CaribCricket. I think that's where it is. Yeah. Like Behram says, same kind of stuff, people. Go and like, share, subscribe, all of that.
Yep. All right, then. Have a fun evening, guys, and the rest of the week as well. We'll be back soon enough with some more fun content. There's a lot of stuff stacked. You guys are pretty much getting a podcast today. And yeah, I'll see you soon enough. Have a good one and goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.